I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world, so much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. At a document on my computer screen, it's kind of amazing how much it's just like looking at actual paper. The sharpness is fantastic. No matter how close I get, I still can't see individual pixels. Same with my smartphone. And we have an invention, actually more like a discovery, from 1907 to thank for that. That's when the light-emitting diode, or LED, was first observed. But it would be half a century before anyone really realized its true potential as a light source. Today, LEDs are everywhere, from household lighting to television screens to computer and phone displays. They're even used to create special effects for film and TV. So this week on The Butterfly Effect, we're shining a tiny light on the LED.
A discovery is always a phenomenal epiphany, I imagine, for the researcher, the scientist, the engineer. But then it's, how do we make this usable? Is this a technology looking for a solution, or do we have something here that we know we can actually use? My name is Carrie Meadows. I am the managing editor of LEDs Magazine. Probably, if you want to know what a light-emitting diode is, you want to know what a diode is, right? Mm-hmm. And a diode is a dual-ended component that allows electric current to flow in one direction via what's called the anode, a positively charged electrode, and it sends the electrons through. But it blocks current in the opposite direction on the cathode end. And diode comes from Greek words meaning two paths, which makes sense. There are lots of different diodes. They serve in all kinds of electronics applications. And some of the earliest ones were as simple as the electronic version of a check valve, where they would stop the flow of current to utilize pulses of current for various purposes. The easiest examples I can think of are signal transmission for telegraph and radio from the very earliest days.
Okay.
And so a light-emitting diode is a semiconductor-based diode. And a semiconductor is its materials that can produce an electrically conductive response between metals and insulator materials. So they have junctions. They're called PN junctions in the semiconductor. And it's like a line of demarcation where the chip of semiconducting material is deliberately doped or impregnated with impurities. And those impurities allow the materials to function differently than they normally would. So when you're building this, you add an electrical charge. So current flows from the P-type side, the positive side, which would be considered the anode, to the N-type side, the negative side, the cathode. but not in reverse. Sounds pretty familiar because it's basically the same as the very generic description of a diode. But these more complex materials and their combinations between the P and the N junction, so you have a junction and then P and N on one side, electrons will move when the charge is applied. And there are gaps called electron holes. So electrons and electron holes together are called charge carriers. And by using different voltages to apply varying amounts of electrical current will cause an electron to meet a hole as it flows into this junction across the middle, and then it falls into a lower energy level than what it originally contained. And when it does that, it releases a photon. And then that happens many times over. Photons are being released, and that is how the diode in the light-emitting diode emits light.
I see. I have to say, I was surprised to learn that LEDs, these light-emitting diodes, have been around for over a century. So can you tell me a bit about Captain H.J. Round and his discoveries as they relate to LEDs?
So I actually thought that was interesting, too. That first development in 1907 that you're talking about apparently is the first electroluminescent reaction reported that came from a silicon carbide crystal with a charge applied to it. And the gentleman that you mentioned, H.J. Round, apparently he was a radio systems developer. And as I imagine with many things, this probably was a happy accident in the beginning. That really limits the amount that I know about the original first discovery, but that actually led to crystal diodes being developed around the same time as what we know of as vacuum tubes, which is what we're usually familiar with from the old radio days and early cathode ray tubes that were used in our old computer monitors and our old televisions. Right. So there was some development of those vacuum tubes around the same time people were realizing we can apply other materials to these structures and we might be able to get a reaction when we apply an electric charge to it. So it's been really, I think of LEDs as being almost like a materials science driven development, and the progress and the roadmap has really been enhanced and advanced over time by people saying, what if we put these materials together? What if we add the holes here? What if we change this material and we make this layer more transparent? What happens when we use this much current? What happens when we interrupt the current? It's just, it's been pretty amazing. It's a combination of material science and quantum physics that is way beyond my level of understanding.
Above my pay grade too. And can you just explain what electroluminescence is?
So electroluminescence is just the property of a material that emits light when an electric current or an electric field is applied to it.
Okay. So the first commercially available LEDs weren't available until the 1960s. So why did it take so long for this technology to be put to use in a commercial context?
So I think the biggest thing that was holding LEDs back for that period of time was really just a question of materials cost, the affordability, the availability of materials, learning the purification process, what types of impurities in those semiconductor layers would create the results that you want, how can you sustain those results, and also how can you make them energy efficient? Because think about this, light is a form of energy. We're converting the electrical current into another form of energy, which is light. So any of the light that doesn't get used is wasted, in essence. It dissipates as heat. And heat, also, as we know from all of our very small electronic devices that we're using these days, heat is a killer of electronics. So that thermal property has to be managed in order for the LED itself and any devices that it's going into to have a reasonable efficiency and operating time and lifetime.
So what were some of the first lighting applications of LEDs?
So initially, early on, the first visible light LED, meaning the kind of light energy that we can see with the human eye, was the red LED. And it wasn't particularly efficient. The amount of power that it took to generate that photonic result, producing the photons, meant that the initial efforts were not extremely bright. So these were usually used as signal indicators, and you'll actually still see them around now as replacements for little incandescent bulbs, or what we call lamps in the LED and lighting market. So that's where you would see them originally, would be in industrial equipment as blinking lights and other indicators. And over time, they experimented with only the external part to create different colors. And then further on, more advances were developed where they realized that by changing the materials that were actually used to make the LED and not the plastic, essentially, that it was encased in, could manipulate the color of the light that you would see coming from it.
Okay. And then what about like in traffic, like in stoplights and in, turn signal indicators on a car? Did that come in fairly early with the LEDs?
So this is another one of those cases where economy for a while really trumped application. The ideas were there. The ability to implement them was there. But it was much more expensive to produce LEDs. Again, think about an automobile. That's a very harsh environment for a teeny tiny piece of electronic equipment that needs to produce light. It's susceptible to vibration of the vehicle. It's susceptible to moisture coming in certain types of places, electrical disturbances, and also, of course, the high heat environment. So your directionals, your indicator lights on your vehicle, your headlamps, your forward-facing headlights, or your tail lamps, those ideas had been around for a while, but they were really restricted to a lot of luxury vehicles for quite some time. And now you're starting to really see them become ubiquitous.
So how did engineers make LEDs bright enough to be used beyond, you know, things like indicating that a switch was on?
Honestly, it came down to the right combination of semiconductor materials and the right amount of current for the proper amount of time. So LEDs, you know, as we've discussed, the diode needs to have current applied to it in order for there to be a reaction and to produce the photon. But you need a certain amount of current for every different application. And, you know, I don't have like a table of what's an appropriate range or anything like that for specific applications, say a table lamp versus a headlight. But the amount of power that it requires will really direct the brightness that you'll get out of it. So there's been some advances in materials like the physical layers that are put together in the electronics process, and also the phosphors that are layered onto LEDs in order to give you the whiter quality of an LED. You've heard people complain, right, about that harsh blue light I don't like that's coming from their outdoor area light on the outside of their house, or the headlights that are glaring across at them. Those perceived colors of light also tend to be brighter to the human eye when you are faced with them.
I see.
So one of the reasons why we have people looking at trying to replicate the incandescent experience across a number of different applications is because they find that warmer, kind of amber, softer light to be more gentle on the eyes.
You're listening to Spark from CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, a special butterfly effect edition. We've been talking about the light-emitting diode, or LED, which has a surprisingly long history. I've been talking to Carrie Meadows, the managing editor of LEDs magazine. Zhenghong Liu is a professor of engineering and materials science at the University of Toronto and the Canada Research Chair in Organic Optoelectronics. His work is on the leading edge of OLED, or organic LED research.
You know, one is sending positive charge, another is sending electrode, negative charge. So when it's positive and negative charge go inside the material, they really positive charge and the negative charge recombine and emit light. So LED is traditional LED made of, as I said, inorganic materials like crystals can withstand very high temperature. There are another type of LEDs called organic LEDs made of inorganic molecules, or in simple term, just like plastic.
Oh, okay.
And just, you know, again, just between two electrodes. So the difference is one is very rigid, traditional LED. The second organic LED is because the plastic is very, very flexible.
I see.
So these are two different type of LEDs.
And how did engineers make LEDs bright enough to be used beyond, you know, indicating that a switch was on or a turn signal indicator in a car?
Well, it's more like really in order for LED to have a broad application, you know, in terms of very large, huge marketplace is, you know, solid state lighting, you know, like a light bulb for energy efficiency. So for that, you need the blue light, you know, to generate blue. So blue light and many materials are very unstable, you know, including early on, people try, you know, like zinc selenide 2-6 compound. They have very, very short lifetime. So you cannot operate very long. So the really, really breakthrough is come in the 1980s, 90s. The Japanese scientist Nakamura, they managed to produce a compound, gallium nitride. It's very blue light, so can operate that very, very long time. So with blue light, you can use some color changing media to convert into other wavelengths like yellow, green, red. So that means you can use for displays and the solid state lighting. So the marketplace all of a sudden become huge. So that's why it was lots of industry put lots of money in, you know, LEDs become so popular. You almost, you know, replace all the lightings in, if you go to Home Depot. Just, LED lighting pretty much replace all incandescent and, fluorescent light bulbs. And in terms of TV markets, really, really taking off.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to get into OLEDs in just a moment. But first of all, when did we first see LEDs used in technology like televisions and other digital screens?
Probably in the late 80s, early 1990s. You know, people try to find a way to replace this very heavy, bulky CRT, you know, cathode ray tube. It's a really, really bulky. People try to find the alternative. So for that, you need a light source, backlight. So that's where the primary application for LED, like backlight for LCD, liquid crystal display. So in the 90s, become popular, as well as for energy efficiency, for light, solid state lighting.
Yeah. And is that why, what makes LEDs better than LCD or plasma for that application? Because they're more energy efficient?
Right. They're more energy efficient. Early on, the plasma television is one competing technology for flat panel display. So LCD is a display technology. It is a backlight. you know, the CCFL was early day used for liquid crystal display, right? So, but LED allow you to more energy efficient, but allow you almost a better color contrast.
So I think they both have their pros and cons. I work for LEDs magazine, and I don't think the LED is the be all and end all to every lighting solution, because we focus so much on lighting applications. Incandescents serve a purpose. They give a pleasing glow. They're not generally harsh on the eyes. The distribution, because inside an incandescent, you're getting a heat reaction from the filament that is receiving the charge. It's more, again, it's more of a glow than a burst of light,
right?
To use like a less technical term. So I think that people just really like that. It gives you a sense of candlelight or sunlight, more evenly distributed, more diffuse, even though sunlight, as we know, can be very, very bright.
Mm-hmm.
But we generally tend to think of it as warmer, even though what's considered daylight color temperature, the perceived color value of the light, is actually pretty cool rather than mm-hmm. warm.
So what does make LEDs advantageous to use?
Energy, 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 flexibility, and controllability. So incandescents in fixtures are just replaceable bulbs, or again, lamps in the lighting industry. And with the LED market, it doesn't have to be a light source that you remove and stick into a fixture every single time. It can be a fixture that becomes part of the space. You've probably seen some of those pretty cool museum installations or art gallery installations, or even public artworks displays, where the materials that are used to create the structure have the LED technology embedded in them. So it feels like the light is emanating from it. And a lot of times what designers are looking for nowadays is light that appears as if it's coming from nowhere, as opposed to what we've been doing for a very long time, which is replicating old fixtures. Track lights. Track lights are one of those things that you see a lot, say in your little coffee shop establishments, maybe that mm-hmm. you've been to. I know around me, there's tons of places that use them. You see them a lot in retail too. The ever-present linear fluorescent tube lighting, that it's got harmful levels of mercury in it. This is stuff that has the potential to contaminate the soil if we throw it in the trash, and it's actually illegal to do that in many places, not in all places, which is why regulation is picking up across different regions. But it's not as energy efficient. If you go on a scale, fluorescent lighting and compact fluorescent lighting is more energy efficient in that it takes fewer watts to produce the amount of light from a CFL or a fluorescent tube than it does from the incandescent version. But it's less reliable because the part that powers and creates that current that goes through the fixture tends to blow out or burn out really easily. So you're constantly seeing a flickering from the inconsistent amount of current coming through fixtures that have fluorescence in them. I bet you've seen that, the doctor's office or the local grocery store, anywhere really. And also you'll see lights that are burned out in various places and people just haven't had the chance to replace them. LEDs, the light producing elements of LEDs, have a very long lifetime. The most vulnerable part is actually the power supply, which is called a driver. And that is just another piece of electronic equipment. It's another set of electronic chips that are designed to regulate the amount of current that goes to the fixture. It keeps the LEDs from burning out before they should. If it's properly designed, the right amount of current will keep the colors from shifting and becoming strange with, say, odd greenish or pinkish tones and things like that. So these are the advantages. Also, controllability. There are hundreds of apps and, you know, consumer facing software capabilities, but there are also professional versions of these things that can help commercial buildings, healthcare, all kinds of businesses, institutional such as education, can help them manage their usage of electricity in lighting and their building systems such as HVAC at the same time, and really help to understand that energy usage in this era where I know we're hearing a lot about the rising cost of energy. And
so how long did it take for LEDs to catch on for household lighting? Was there resistance to replacing incandescent bulbs?
I think there is still some resistance to incandescent replacement, honestly. There, for every instance in which I've had a conversation, just a personal or anecdotal conversation with someone about what I learn about, what I write about, what I ask contributors to convey to our audience, I think at least one out of every five people tells me, "Oh, I tried LEDs and I didn't like them. The light was terrible, and then all these other things happened." And I said, "Well, you." What kind of light bulb did you buy? And then they'll say, "Oh, I bought it online for, you know, a dollar."
Right.
I say, "Well, I love a good bargain and I won't lie about that. But to be honest, you do get what you pay for in many cases. An incandescent bulb and an LED bulb, when you're holding them one in each hand, one is going to have a sticker price that is much less expensive. When you just compare that. But if you compare the lumens per watts, so lumens, the amount of luminous output that the lamp or the bulb provides, versus the amount of wattage that has to come into the fixture in order to produce those, and the length of time that lamp is going to last you, it will cost you less eventually. Mm-hmm. It's just a really, really weird math problem for most people.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Spark.
You're listening to Spark.
You're listening to Spark.
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 I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Today we're talking about the long history and bright, literally, future of the LED. I've been speaking to Zhenghong Liu, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Organic Optoelectronics at the University of Toronto, and Carrie Meadows, the managing editor of LEDs magazine. They'll rejoin us shortly. LEDs are revolutionizing another industry you might not immediately think of: television and film. If you've ever seen, say, an Avengers movie, you know that there are thousands of special effects, impossible landscapes, buildings exploding, and so on. Traditionally, those have been done using giant green screens. The actors act in front of the screen, and the backgrounds and special effects are added after the filming is finished. But what if there was a way to have those backgrounds behind the actors in real time?
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
recent shows like The Mandalorian have been using giant LED screens that blend into the set with perfect precision, creating much more realistic effects.
It's using some of that virtual technology, most notably video game engines, to generate backgrounds in real time. My name is Kevin McGee. I am a virtual production and visual effects supervisor based out of Toronto, Ontario.
I've seen some pictures and videos of your studio or others like it, and it's pretty dramatic, pardon the pun. So can you describe what it looks like when you're inside one of these things that I understand is called the volume?
If you basically picture the biggest TV set you've ever seen and then bend it. So where a lot of people are familiar with the image of a green screen or a blue screen where you have an actor standing in front of, you know, a big blank wall, we fill that wall in with a giant TV set. And as the camera moves around, we actually use tracking technology to have the wall update in the same way you would a video game controller and you can fly around the world. We do the same thing to update the background. So if they're, say, driving in a car, the giant TV set, for lack of better description, would update, you know, with the streets and the people on the outside and the buildings flying by. So yeah, it's basically a, much like you would see at a sports game. They have the LED signs. We use similar components to add backgrounds to film.
And so if I am an actor, I'm kind of inside this thing that's sort of surrounding me on all sides. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's a very interesting experience for actors, because one thing that people have had struggles with in a lot of recent filmmaking is when they're just staring at a green screen, there's nothing there. And so to get emotion and to get eye lines, you know, make it feel like they're actually encompassing the same space, that can be a real challenge when there's nothing there to engage with. The nice thing about this is when they're looking at something, they're actually looking at it. It's there with them. It can be an odd experience in that it only really looks correct through the camera. And when you see it from outside of it, sometimes things seem a little bit distorted. But ultimately, it at least gives them something to interact with. They can feel they're in the environment. They can feel that they're, you know, talking in the same space that they should be emoting in, and, you know, do what they do best, which is embody their character in the space instead of having to also imagine the space.
Right. So as I understand it, besides running a production studio, you're also a visual effects artist. So how do you create a set inside one of these things?
Yeah, so a big change that I think that's really nice in this part of the industry is it's really bringing back that culture of planning, where, you know, we've got so much technology now that can let us fix things way downstream. You know, the joke on set is always fix it in post-production being everything that happens, you know, editorial and onwards. That's a real challenge because now you're trying to make creative decisions long after the fact. For us, we try to work ahead of production. So sitting, you know, it starts with a concept meeting, sitting down with, you know, your directors and your producers and really trying to decide what are we going to have to see in on the day. Because just like building a practical set, we need to make sure that those things are available. If we need to see a building, if we need to see the desert, if we need to see the ocean, we want to make sure that we're preparing as much of that as possible ahead of time so that when we get there, we're not scrambling to try and put things together, just like building a practical set. Okay. So sometimes we talk to art directors to see what type of, you know, things they're going to be using elsewhere in the film. We may talk to, you know, set decorators to see what props they're using. You know, maybe I need to source something, maybe I need to make something. And very much we treat it like a real practical set.
I understand there's a group of people working just outside the circle of the screen while you're shooting. What do they do?
So I have a team of artists that work with me on the day who all have very dedicated tasks. So some handle making lighting changes. So for instance, say it's a nighttime scene and suddenly we need to move a little bit later in the script and it needs to be brighter out, they can start to make those adjustments. At other times, maybe they'll ask for a certain piece of the set to be moved or adjusted. Maybe something is very distracting in the frame and needs to be taken out. So I'll have layout artists go, and in between takes, we're tweaking, you know, we're always adjusting things. And I think that's one thing that really catches people off guard is how much we can change on the day and, you know, how we can finesse things in much the same way a traditional production may cover up a logo that's in the shot because they can't get the rights to it. we may not have a logo in our scene, but maybe we have a building that doesn't look quite right and they want us to move it. We would do those types of adjustments.
What's made it possible for this type of technology to be used? Is it just that the, you know, we're now at a point where it doesn't look pixelated or anything? Like, how is it that this is becoming a prominent technology?
So the big issue that we tend to experience or try to avoid experiencing whenever possible is cumulative error. So little bits of undesirable aspects that build up. So for instance, the panels we run, in much the same way, if you recorded a video on your cell phone of a TV set, you may see that TV set flickering. Mm-hmm. That can occur in camera. But now we're able to run these panels much faster, and we're able to jam them. So jamming being that we're synchronizing the camera with the panels so that they, you know, it's recording and rendering at the exact same time, so we don't see flicker. Similarly, in much the same way an old TV set may have been really blurry by today's standards, and now we have high def 4K, 8K TVs, the number just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Yeah. The panels are very similar. So we deal with a value called pixel pitch, and that's mm-hmm. how far apart the individual pixels or the diodes on the panels are. And now they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which means the image to the human eye looks more and more realistic. And similarly, just ultimately, they're a lot brighter now. You can have them in camera and they read more correctly. We can do more things with color. But it's really accumulation of small victories that the industry has had, you know, since the 1960s. If we think back to actually going back to the 30s, that's when people started playing with a thing called rear projection. That was, you'd put a film projector, just like, you know, we used to go in the theater and they had the big reels of film and, mm-hmm. you know, you'd put them up and very much the same. You could put a background back there. And we saw a lot of this, you know, for instance, the classic example would be James Bond driving a car.
Okay.
And he's driving and the background is playing behind him and it works, but you can tell that he's not there in real time and space. Yeah. There's always a little bit of a, there's something not quite right there. And as audiences' eyes have gotten better and better, and we've gotten used to knowing that our eyes are being tricked, the VFX artist's challenge is always to try and stay one step ahead of a rapidly educating audience. Mm-hmm. People can't always say what's quite wrong, but they can feel it's off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that then, and then throughout, say, you know, the 90s into the early 2000s, you had some filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and ILM on the film AI playing, I think it was 2001, playing with video games and using video game controllers to pre-visualize things. So they were sorting out the other side of things. They were sort of sorting out the content. How do we make images that will go up on the screen? So now we have screens, we have this, and then, you know, you have people starting to go, okay, well, that's sort of neat. What if we used it to light the environment? Okay, well, we need brighter screens. Well, what if we could, you know, change the lighting in real time? Well, then we need video game engines. And stacking up these little technologies that are coming from totally different industries.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my crew here come from industries totally disrelated to film. A lot of them are coming, they're programmers, they're video game developers. They're doing things that they never thought would be transferable mm-hmm. to this industry, and all of a sudden are. And it's a really neat experience when you get a new diversity of thought, because suddenly they're bringing in things, you know, from industries that I wouldn't have thought to look at. There's a lot of recent examples that have been very public. Star Trek, The Mandalorian, very public uses of this technology. And what's interesting is then you start digging into the history and realize that they were coming off of things like in 2013, the film Oblivion and the film Gravity. They were using similar technology, just not for the whole production, for certain mm-hmm. aspects like lighting or integration. Mm-hmm. So a lot of little victories over a long time really accumulate to something totally unexpected.
You talked a little bit about what the experience is like from an actor's perspective. Is it ever disorienting? Like, do people walk into the screen forgetting that it's not real?
Well, you have to have somebody walk into the screen, but we definitely give a little bit of a start of day warning to new crews that, you know, a production day can be a long day. It's a very bright screen, so we definitely encourage a lot of eye breaks. But the big one is some environments, you know, spaceships hurling through space, that's a whole lot of motion coming at you. And some people react better than others. I have heard of shoots where people have been a little bit ill to their stomachs. But typically we're trying to do short enough takes and give people enough rest that that's not an issue. And people get used to it fairly quickly.
Yeah. I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the use of green screens, at least the basics of it. So what are some of the production advantages for using a wall of OLEDs for backgrounds instead of a green screen?
The big thing that we get off of it is integration. So making it feel like everything was captured in one space at one time. You know, we've spent about 120 years developing cameras as we know them for film, and they do what they do very well. They capture images, they add effects that would be really hard to recreate virtually, blooms and glares and depth of field, things that we've grown to have a certain lexicon around when we're watching movies, things we've grown to expect, things that we find aesthetically pleasing. When you do things fully digital and you put them back there, that can be really hard to recreate. If you can recreate it at all, it can be very expensive, it can be very slow, and ultimately it's very difficult to make it feel like they're in the exact same space. So things like reflections, you know, if a person has glasses and you shoot them in front of a green screen, you now either have to replace or, you know, composite in, as in add in a fake reflection to their glasses, or not do it at all, or hope nobody notices. And it still feels a little bit removed. Maybe the audience can't quite put their finger on it, but something feels a little bit off. When you shoot with the screen, the nice thing is you're lighting the subject matter with it. They're engaging with it. It's going to be as bright as they are. It's going to have similar colors there. And as things are moving, it feels like they're married together. And it just really, it gets those little bits of cumulative benefit. You know, hair will feel better. It won't feel like it's, you know, cut out or sometimes people feel very silhouetted on green screen because it's very also hard to predict the lighting. So the challenge to the director of photography, who is in charge of all the optical components, you know, how they light things, how they block things, that's a big challenge for someone when they don't know what they're actually lighting to. It's a real trust relationship between the visual effects supervisor and the director of photography. To understand, I'm going to light this a certain way. You're going to add a background that will complement that. And if all goes well, we'll meet in the middle. It's much nicer to make those decisions on the day and together there and then, where now I can actually sit with the director of photography and say, this is how I can add my lighting components. This is how you'll add your lighting components. This is what they look at. What do we want to keep? What do we want to change? And the dialogue just happens much quicker and much more organically. It's much more familiar to anybody who grew up, you know, with their parents' camcorder, making videos with their friends, and you can make decisions on the fly. Getting back to a little bit of that energy, a little bit of that excitement is a really, really nice thing when, you know, we got into the creative arts to be creative.
Yeah.
And sometimes a big blank wall can be a little bit intimidating.
But are there any challenges with this technology in terms of like getting shadows and color right, just because you have so much light coming from the screen?
Absolutely. So the wall itself can throw quite a bit of light, but it can be a little bit hard to direct at times. So it's a very soft light source. So sometimes we infill with some practical lights to make things a little bit harsher. Similarly, there's a lot of different cameras on the market, and they all handle color a little bit differently. As a result, we have to make sure that we accommodate a lot of different possible hardware stacks that different clients may bring in. Some people like shooting on one camera, some people like shooting on another. Making sure that it actually reads correctly means we always have to go through an integration period. And, you know, we talk about blend days with our clients, which is when we don't plan to shoot anything. We actually just sit as a team, go through what's going to be shot, look at the camera. Again, look at what feels real, look at what feels fake, and try to nudge out as much of the artificial feeling parts as possible. You know, there's also just physical limitations to the fact that it's a physical screen fairly close to the talent. So if you want someone to feel very far away, we have tricks to do that, but ultimately it is fairly close to them. So there can be challenges. With that said, the technology is moving so fast that we're yet to find the shot we can't do. There's almost always a way to do it. Some you just have to get more novel than others.
Right. I know productions like The Mandalorian and Star Trek Discovery have used this kind of technology, but overall, how's the uptake for these virtual sets?
It's been great. I think like a lot of pieces of technology, once people know that it's available and it's been proven, they become a little more willing to dip that toe. So even though we've been talking about this as like, you know, a dream technology for quite a while, those types of productions really made people look at it and go, huh, maybe I don't have the money that, say, a Mandalorian has, but maybe I can do a few shots that are really important to the story I'm trying to tell. Maybe I choose one or two scenes and I shoot the rest of the film practically how I know how to do it. And I try it this way. You know, we're seeing more commercials getting into this space. It's exciting. You know, if they're trying to tell a story around a product, you know, being able to show it in different locations without actually having to fly all over the place has been really good. Also, a lot of productions now being very conscious of the impact of travel. That is, you know, it's not the most environmentally friendly thing. While the wall does require power to run it, it's a small fraction of the impact of, say, flying actors all over the world, flying equipment all over the world. So there's benefits like that. Yeah, so there's artistic benefits. There's, you know, there's schedule benefits. Often there's budget benefits. I know my clients love when there's budget benefits, so we fight for them as hard as we can. Really depends on the project. But we're seeing all types of projects come forward and really trying to find ways to get it in front of more people, because the more people who see it, the more challenges we solve, you know, the further we can push this.
Kevin, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin McGee is the head of virtual production at Toronto's Virtual Production House.
You're listening to Spark on CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. This week on Spark's Butterfly Effect series, we're talking about the impact of the LED, how it's affecting everything from lighting to smartphones to, as you just heard, the film industry. Here's more of my conversation with Carrie Meadows, the managing editor of LEDs magazine, and Zhenghong Liu, a professor of engineering and materials science at the University of Toronto. Can you explain a little more about how OLED is different from regular LEDs?
Well, OLED is basically traditional LED. You need make LED at high temperature to grow single crystals, right? And sometimes quite expensive, even though the cost is down significantly. So organic LED is just you don't need to make crystals because each individual molecules are perfect. You just, you know, they spray the molecule onto a substrate like plastic. And so you can make same principle. You apply voltage across two electrodes, you know, like a sandwich structure, you know, they will emit light. So the technology, the concept of, you know, making molecules to emit light is actually proposed by scientists from National Research Council in Ottawa. In the 1965, people tried.
Really?
Yeah. They published paper in Physical Review Letter, just, you know, observed light emission from this material made of molecules. But at that time, the driving voltage is so high, cost a few hundred volts, just very, very dim. So people forgot all about it.
Yeah. And that's such a common thing in inventions, right? Where there's some reason why it can't be commercially applied, and much later it comes to be seen what the value is.
That's right. Because the scientific principle is there, but the technology is not there to make it more efficient. So it is later on, you know, the scientists at the Bell Laboratory, they invented a technique called molecular beam epitaxy. So it allow you to lay down materials one atomic layer at a time called molecular BMAP taxi. So using the same concept in the 1980s to form an ultra-thin layer so that the driving voltage to produce, you know, particle light from a few hundred volt down to a few volt. So that means it's possible to make industrial, you know, commercial product.
So I understand you've been working on flexible OLED screens. So what are some of the challenges in making screens that you can bend or even fold?
The major challenge is the cost. The industrial tools still not mature enough to really make, low-cost, flexible screens. And except for niche applications like foldable phones, people don't mind pay a premium. You know, in terms of, you know, someday we want something like flexible, like lighting source, for example, inside the car for automobiles, inside the house, large area. So the cost is very sensitive.
Are there other uses for LEDs that are being developed now? Like what other applications might there be that might surprise us?
There are things that I think are already in use that people don't even necessarily think about. So automotive driver assistance systems. So sensors are a big part of what people are doing with LEDs these days. LEDs are being used in the LiDAR sensor systems that send out signals and bounce them back and then analyze them and say, okay, there's a pedestrian in front of you, or you're getting too close to that vehicle in front of you at the rate of speed you're traveling right now, etc. And then you'll get those warnings that go off. It's not just about flashing lights or producing colored lights, like immersive gaming experiences is something that has been prevalent at, say, the Consumer Electronics Show, the big show that happens in Vegas every year. Those types of applications have really been on the forefront of getting lights to communicate with the other devices we're using at the time, such as our computers and our gaming consoles, and say, here's what's happening in the room right now. Create an effect or an ambiance that matches what I'm doing. Well, that's great, but it's still about illumination. We're at the point now where we can actually use the LEDs themselves to communicate information. Indoor location services, you might get those in a wayfinding app inside a building or, say, a retail environment. If you participate in their retail environment application where they send you notifications when they know that you're in the store, a lot of those have to do with what's called visible light communications or non-visible light communications, or also known as Li-Fi, light fidelity. So it's a network that uses lighting and electronics to send signals and data back and forth. And the difference with that in terms of indoor applications is that it's not going to be interfered with like Wi-Fi. When you have too many people on the network, when you're using Wi-Fi in a location, these light signals are only being used for specific communications applications.
Carrie Meadows is the managing editor of LEDs magazine. Zhenghong Liu is a professor of engineering and materials science at the University of Toronto, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Organic Optoelectronics. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Adam Killick, Olsi Sarakana, Samarit Johannes, and me, Nora Young, and by Carrie Meadows, Zhenghong Liu, and Kevin McGee. Special thanks this week to Davin Lengel. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.